You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you send and receive calls and texts from your new business phone number. That way, you can run your business from anywhere and respond to clients quickly with Grasshopper's mobile apps. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. That's grasshopper.com/kick. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. The past year was something of a roller coaster ride for our seventh president, Andrew Jackson, old Hickory to his friends. In spring of last year, Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew proposed replacing Jackson on the $20 bill with Harriet Tubman, only for his successor, Steve Mnuchin, to later walk back that idea, suggesting that he might opt to keep Jackson right where he is. Numerous comparisons were drawn between the populist campaign of Donald Trump in 2016 and the emergence of Jacksonian Democrats in the 1820s, so much so that President Trump has honored Jackson by hanging his portrait in the Oval Office. While others have called for the removal of public statues of the former slaveholder, the most famous of which depicts a victorious Jackson astride his horse in Jackson Square in New Orleans' French Quarter. It's a sure bet that many of the drunken revelers who pass by that statue 200 years later haven't a clue why he holds this place of honor in the park outside St. Louis Cathedral. But it's entirely likely that if it weren't for Andrew Jackson, New Orleans probably wouldn't be a part of the United States today, and in fact, the United States of America might not even exist. The victory that won the War of 1812 and made Jackson a hero is now the subject of a new book titled Andrew Jackson and the Miracle of New Orleans, The Battle That Shaped America's Destiny, by Brian Kilmeade and Don Yeager. You know Brian Kilmeade as the co-host of Fox News Channel's morning show, Fox and Friends, and his daily radio show, The Brian Kilmeade Show. His previous books, George Washington's Secret Six and Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, were bestsellers, and today Brian comes on the podcast to talk about his latest offering, about Jackson and the miraculous battle that saved New Orleans and America. He'll talk about the confrontation with a British officer that became a defining moment for a young Andrew Jackson, how Jackson led an army with a bullet wound to his shoulder and dysentery, and how Jackson never deserted his men and threatened to shoot any one of them who deserted him. He'll discuss why New Orleans was so strategically important to the United States, how Jackson's army was able to defeat the British in a mere 45 minutes, and what the consequences might have been if Jackson had lost. Plus, he'll weigh in on recent calls to reevaluate Jackson's place in the history books and the comparisons between the seventh president and number 45. Coming up with Brian Kilmeade in just a moment. Today, I'm happy to welcome Brian Kilmeade back to the podcast. He's the co-host of Fox News Channel's morning show, Fox and Friends, and host of the daily national radio show, The Brian Kilmeade Show. He's also a best-selling author, and his latest book, written with Don Yeager, is Andrew Jackson and the Miracle of New Orleans, The Battle That Shaped America's Destiny. Brian Kilmeade, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on. Congratulations on the success, man. Is there anyone in America not clicking on your podcast? I'd like to know who they are.
I don't think President Trump is, and I know he watches your show.
You know what? So I'm going to talk to him about it.
Okay, please do. Well, last time we talked about your book, Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, and all of your books about American history seem to explore a famous figure such as Washington or Jefferson or Andrew Jackson via a particular chapter in their life. So with Andrew Jackson, why did you decide to zero in on the Battle of New Orleans as opposed to doing his presidency or some thousand-page, all-encompassing biography about all 78 years?
Well, because I'm fatigued every time I pick up the book by Ron Chernow, Grant. Yeah. I mean, it just exhausts me. I'm on page 300. I'm a third through. So I'm not capable of doing the all-encompassing biography of anyone. I just know I don't have the time. I don't think I'm good at it. What I like to do is find something, one area of a person's life that, in this case, I've always been fascinated personally about American history, and try to bring something new to it, almost as if I'm working on a story here at Fox. Mm-hmm. Try to bring something new to it and tell it in a quick, compelling, accurate way. So when I talk about the spy ring, I worked on that for 20 years. I always thought it would be a great movie, as I mentioned to you. And then Tripoli Pirates, because we're always talking about war on terror, you know, on radio and on television. And every time someone wants to put it in perspective, they always went back and said, you know, Jefferson had to deal with Islamic extremists, as did Washington and Adams. And they always try to ground you there. And that got me to the Jefferson Library, where I thought there was a book there. And then with this, I thought about a War of 1812 would be logical in terms of a timeline. And I thought first, the Battle of Baltimore. You know, we withstood after Washington burned. We stood up and took the fire and wrote the – Francis Scott Key wrote the national anthem. But then I got led to the Battle of New Orleans, because the 3rd Infantry, 2nd Brigade is where I stayed before the Iraq War. And they always talked about the cotton ballers and the history, how they stood up to the British and won a brutal battle in historic ways. And I was thought, I'm going to tell this story, even though I knew the Treaty of Ghent was signed and they didn't have to fight it. That's what they told us in school. But the research revealed the British had every intention of holding on to New Orleans. It was a party town back then, too. Some of them brought their wives. They were going to be on Bourbon Street on Christmas Day. Instead, on January 8th, Jackson had won the big victory in under 45 minutes, and they held on to the city, and they still celebrate it today.
Now, given that Andrew Jackson was a slaveholder and responsible for the Trail of Tears, had somewhat mixed record as a president, were you worried that it was politically risky to write a book exalting Old Hickory?
Well, I mean, I look at a couple of other things. I mean, obviously, the Indian Removal Act that resulted in the Trail of Tears after he left the office, not really doing what John Meacham did. Although he's on the back of the book, and I made sure that he thought the book was accurate. I'm not looking to do the historical – I'm not looking at his presidency. I wanted to see what made him the most famous man in America, and that was the Battle of New Orleans. Now, to put in perspective, I think we're in a real trouble road when we look at people in 2017 as if they lived today and say, what were you thinking? You know, what were you thinking with slaves? Who can justify slavery? Nobody. You know, who can justify the Trail of Tears? Nobody. You know, the Indian Wars going back and forth. Lincoln fought them. All the way up to Teddy Roosevelt. Every president had to deal with American Indian issues, and sometimes there were brutal battles around them. I am not going to say I know I would have handled it better, or that Clinton would have handled it better, or that FDR would have handled it better. But I would say that FDR, Truman, Teddy Roosevelt, as well as Lincoln and Reagan, all looked up to Jackson. They looked at him as an icon. They studied his presidency. And that really gave me the foundation to think, and knowing that he made the 20, at one point some very smart people thought he was one of the best. And now today they're trying to look at him through the 2017 lens and said, what were you thinking? I think I could look at a guy that's orphaned at 13, who becomes a lawyer, an attorney general, a congressman, a senator, a self-taught major general, then a militia general, and then a general, and then a two-term president, and thought, you know, that's an American story that needs to be told. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. And this one moment, nothing short of miraculous.
You open by recounting this famous story of this formative moment in Andrew Jackson's young life during the Revolution. Tell us about that and how that shaped him.
Yeah, I mean, putting that as the introduction or first chapter was an ongoing debate, but essentially it's this. And we have one of the pictures depicting it. And finally, for this, I'm able to get a picture in there. Andrew Jackson, as he actually looked in his almost in his last year of life, there's a picture in the book. But most of them are sketches. So picture this. The whole family has grown up hating the British from their years in Scotland. So the war, the Revolutionary War starts. The dad had passed away before he was born. The older brother dies in the war. He's got another brother that's old, 1 year older than him, and they're dying to get in the war, even though they're 13 and 14. Much like our your listeners, they're always dying to get into war as a young teen. So they're in the Revolutionary War, and he's a scout, and he is a courier. They catch him. They track him back to his aunt's house, and in there, they say, first, you're under arrest. He's like, fine. And he said, well, because I had to walk through the mud to get you, clean my shoes. He said, no, I'm not cleaning your shoes. I'm a prisoner of war. You should be treating me like that. So the guy picks up his sword and comes down on him. He puts his hand up, and his hand and head get sliced. He has those scars the rest of his life. They do the same thing with his brother, but his brother couldn't get his hand up high enough. He suffers a head injury. He never fully recovers. They walk what they claim was 30 miles in the winter to a camp. And their mom just wouldn't give up getting them out. They finally work at a prisoner exchange. By the time they get him home, the brother dies one day in the house. The mom, realizing it's just her and Andrew, she goes out and she goes and starts working for another section of the family to earn some money. She ends up dying. He's alone. When a trunk of her clothes arrives on his doorstep, he realizes he's alone in this world. He gets raised by his town, his extended family, his village. Puts himself through whatever was law school was back then and made himself this perpetuate this success story through the backwoods of Tennessee and North Carolina. So that's why I thought to tell this guy says, I was born in a storm. I'm most comfortable there. He's not kidding.
Fast forward a few decades to around the time of the War of 1812. You talk about the fact that the Secretary of War had been a field surgeon but had no combat experience, and the heroes of the Revolution had all aged out by 1812. There was a real dearth of experienced American military officers to lead a war. Was that part of the reason that Jackson was able to rise through the ranks so quickly?
Well, he begged to get in the war right away, and they basically looked at what I think something you should take away from this book that I had no idea I was getting into until the research started, was, do you know how the people in the Midwest feel as though people on the East and West Coast think they're above them? Mm-hmm. That is the same way they felt in, which is now, you know, just barely the Midwest. So in Tennessee and North Carolina down south, they always felt as though they were second-class citizens. When Jackson had a bit of a name, he put his hand up and said, you know, let me fight this war. I know how to fight them. They said, we'll get back to you. And when every other general was failing miserably, and they thought this was a great idea, when in doubt, and one of the chapters is named How to Lose a War, we thought, I have a good idea. Let's take on the British, but let's fight them in Canada. So take whatever troops we had, leave our whole country naked and unprotected, and go to Canada and try to beat them out there. And what happens? Our whole East Coast gets terrorized. Yeah. So next thing you know, Washington's burned to the ground, and they finally have to turn to Jackson. And when they do that, he's got his 1,400 guys, and they're ready to tear it up. And he's drilled them, he's worked with them, and they're ready to fight. And from the Creek Indians to the British themselves, they start fighting and having success all over the South, knowing that the ultimate battle would be New Orleans.
Yeah, and I enjoyed the chapter you just mentioned, How to Lose a War, because we probably weren't in a position to fight another war with the most powerful military in the world who had just vanquished Napoleon, much less go and annex Canada. Was it foolhardy for America to start a war when it didn't have the wherewithal to adequately defend ourselves?
That's a great question. And the thing is, they say this is the smallest margin we ever had okaying the war. You had a bunch of war hawks who get elected and they win, but the northern states want nothing to do with it. In fact, the British get word on that, so they don't even attack Massachusetts and New York. They said, listen, we have a chance of winning these guys back without firing a shot. So when we go into this war, we're all pumped up, but we're not ready. We have 40,000 men total, all fractured, all defending their states, but not their country. After this, we would have one cohesive military. But then it was just, I got my state. Don't worry about it. And these militias weren't trained. They did other things. And as soon as they got pressured, they would just break up and run because they had no leadership. It was different with Jackson. And from there on in, we'd had one unified army. We had a pretty good navy, but they were small. When the British finally defeat Napoleon, they think they're going to just go for peace with us. Instead, they double down. We had 40,000 troops total. They sent an extra 40 to finish us off.
Wow.
After they beat Napoleon. And that's what made this so amazing. We're still outnumbered virtually 2-1. and they were still able to win in under 45 minutes when the battle actually took place. And what I loved about it, say what you want about Jackson, he put the free men of color, he armed everyone. He Cherokee Indians, Choctaw Indians, the Pirates, they had what you really kind of mobsters, privateers.
Yeah.
And you had Kentuckians and Tennesseans. He made them into one unit. He also treated them all equally. He demanded that they treat men of color. Back then, they said, whatever you do, don't give them guns. He's like, I'm giving them guns. You're going to pay them. You're going to feed them. And if there's a problem, I'm going to come back and I'm going to shoot you. So he made them come together and fight as one. He also, you know, as what did he say about Indians? All true. He also adopted an Indian boy who tragically passed away at 18 before he went to the White House.
Right.
So he's a bit of a dichotomy there.
Yeah.
You know, there's no all good or all bad.
For those who may not remember, remind us, what exactly was the War of 1812 really about?
Oops, I forgot to find that out. No, essentially, it was a couple of things. When the Revolutionary War ended, they never fully acknowledged we won. So they said, we're supposed to leave the Midwest. Instead, they stayed. They were supposed to stop harassing our ships. Instead, they did. They took about 1,000 of our men off merchant and military ships because they needed people, because they wanted to harass and disrespect. They also would take these Indian tribes and they would arm them, train them, just to harass our settlers. So as we moved out west, there were a lot of massacres that took place of people who had no interest in taking land or starting a fight, but the British wanted us to stop expanding. So they took 1,000 of our guys. They would clog up our trading lanes, and they would also just refuse to acknowledge America as an emerging power. Wherever we went, they felt as though when Madison took over, the only thing we could do to get their respect is to fight them. And Jefferson pushing Madison the whole time. Yeah, go ahead and do this. And when we did it, we just were ill-prepared to fight it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people thought this was an unnecessary war. Some called it our second war, our second Revolutionary War. And James Madison called it our War of Adolescence. So it just was a natural progression. And keep in mind, we ended up surviving and fighting to a draw against the world's number one military power, only this time without the French.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jackson, almost from the beginning of the war, seems to be screaming at the top of his lungs, New Orleans, New Orleans. You see in his correspondence with Madison and the leaders in Washington, we have to protect New Orleans. We have to defend New Orleans. That's the key. Why was New Orleans so important?
Well, New Orleans was backed up to the Mississippi. And keep in mind, too, and I describe this, not as much detail as I originally thought I would because I wanted to keep the book moving. But, you know, Jackson won originally when they called his name and said, okay, report for duty. We need your guys. He's like, all right, I'll go to New Orleans because you know they're going to want to take the Mississippi, control the mouth of the Mississippi, and stop us from actually growing the country west as the spine of the country, as Jackson viewed it. And he gets there. He's almost there. And they say, yeah, come on back. He's like, really? My guys are exhausted. We've been on foot for hundreds of miles. Come back. So we had to turn around and come back. Half the guys were sick. They had abandoned their farms and people. By the time they got back, they were basically done with their months of service. So not only did he not accomplish anything, he had to give up half his men back to civilian life. So when we finally gets in the war, he convinces a lot of them to fight again, gets them healthy again, gets new people. And then when he goes back to New Orleans with 1,400 guys, he doubles the force, a little bit more than doubles the force with those the Choctaw Indians and the Cherokees, as well as the free men of color and local militia in New Orleans. So there was some stops and starts. But just picture this, and I did it. And if you go to BrianKilmeade.com, I have many videos. And I did an hour special on Fox News on December 10th. You see what New Orleans means. You see where the British landed. You see if they were going to undo the Louisiana Purchase. They felt like Napoleon had no right to sell it to Jefferson. So we found paperwork that showed that their goal was to make America hostage in their own country and control the South and put a backstop, almost a Jersey bump, on the Midwest. And the Mississippi was going to do that if we lost New Orleans.
Yeah, and it's interesting because at the same time as the war is being fought and he's heading down to New Orleans, Henry Clay was in Ghent trying to negotiate a peace with the British, but it seems like there was some double dealing on behalf of England. And I mean, were the Brits less than honest brokers in these peace negotiations?
No question. There's no question. And we had very little leverage. And when word got out that Washington was burned, which was breaking war etiquette, whatever that meant, you know, Paris was never born. London wasn't burned. You know, Moscow wasn't burned. You know, what they did was that, you know, that they did their scorched earth policy, but they never burned capitals. For some reason, the British thought it was okay to burn ours. And that really mobilized the entire country. But it gave the, you know, the guys negotiating the peace treaty, then including John Quincy Adams, very little leverage because we were getting just hammered. How do you walk in and go for a peace treaty when we have absolutely no leverage? And they're saying to themselves, the Hartford Convention took place. You're about to lose six states. Even though we're a nation of 8 million people now, almost doubled in population and size, we were vulnerable and maybe stretched a little too thin. And when the British were doing their negotiation, you know, it wasn't going well for us.
Andrew Jackson was actually sort of making the classic mistake of fighting a war on two fronts because he was forced into the position of having to fight the Red Stick Indians at the same time as we were fighting the British. If he hadn't won the Battle of Horseshoe Bend and vanquished the Red Stick Indians, is it likely that that we wouldn't have won the Battle of New Orleans?
Might not have gotten there, especially if we lost, because, as you know, the Red Sticks were brutal. They had, I mean, I describe it in there. I'd rather not go over it again for people. But, I mean, the kids were tortured. Women and children were killed. I mean, they were basically massacring unarmed people. So they sent Jackson in there with his men to get a measure of revenge and essentially saddle them, sideline them, destroy them. And he's coming back off being shot in a duel. And the bullet is still in it. You know, they wanted to take off his arm. He's barely mobilized. There was a bullet still by his lung. So he has to get his guys and take over this really tough fighting Red Creek crowd. And he did. And they destroyed them. But if had he lost, I can't imagine them having the morale or the men to get to rally together to go to New Orleans.
Yeah, and by the time Jackson heads down to New Orleans, you know, he's not in his best form. Like you said, he's been shot. He has a bad arm. He can barely get on his
horse.
Dysentery. I mean, he was not in great shape, really, when he got down to New Orleans, right?
No, he was suffering from dysentery. They say he was 6'1", 140 pounds.
Wow.
140 pounds. And they thought New Orleans was shaking as a group because they saw how the East Coast was tortured and terrorized. And I said, this is coming to us. I mean, if these Americans don't get here quick, it's going to happen to us. And when Jackson had this great reputation, but he showed up, he looked like a skeleton and a mess. But he went in there, quickly took control of the situation. I talked to a couple of doctors, and I said, what is dysentery, and what is it like to have it? And they said, you're incapable of having anything pleasurable. Doesn't matter food,
wow.
Doesn't matter sleep. You are just in so much pain.
Oof.
So he had to put on a front to let everyone in New Orleans know things are going to be fine, to let his men know you have a leader that's in charge to lead you to victory. Yet in deep down, he knew how much he was suffering. He'd hop on a horse and just keep going back and forth miles, trying to figure out what battle plan he could put together, anticipate where the British were going to come on to land, and then think what kind of way he would repel them. He's even on a horse, they said, going a mile would be painful, let alone spending a whole day on that.
Wow.
So it's unbelievable what he had to overcome to do it, which brings me back to your original question. Like, you know, Jackson is a controversial figure. Why do it? Well, this isn't controversial. To me, he saved the country and kept us on our mission to expand westward.
Another key figure in this story is the pirate Jean Lafitte, who had been courted originally by the British, and he was offered a sweetheart deal if he and his men would join forces with them, but he eventually chose to fight alongside Jackson. What won this calculating privateer with no particular allegiance to decide to fight with the Americans?
He hated the British more than he liked us.
Yeah.
And the British offered him this deal. They're so smart that he said, let me think about it for a week. You know, they offered him and said, you can be an officer. We'll get rid of your criminal record. You're going to love your new life. What do you think? And they go, you know, we're going to control this country. So you might as well side with the eventual winners. So 2 weeks later, he goes up to the governor and says, listen, I got this offer. I don't want to take it. I'd rather fight with you guys. I kind of like what America offers. So get me with Jackson. So the governor says, listen, I got these pirates. He's and Jackson's like, yeah, they're criminals. He goes, well, they can help us. He's like, I don't want to, you know, I don't need your help. I don't need that kind of help because they have guys and they're great fighters and they have ammo and they got flint. He goes, let me talk to them. Sure enough, they provided all this material. They provided guys. They were great fighters and they also hated the British by the way they treated the Caribbean as basically their garage. So they wanted to fight back and the British were always hassling him anyway. So he was able to really bolster our forces and provide wanted material and better yet, let us know the terrain. So helped us with the terrain. Yeah. So if the British came in here, they're going to have a problem moving their cannons up. If they come in here, there's only one way to go. That helped them narrow out where they would build this mini berm and dig this canal and kind of backstop to New Orleans to know that the British were going to be successful. They literally would have to run through the entire fighting force.
Wow.
And Jackson liked his chances. He liked his chances of surviving it. But the pirates were indispensable. Although there's no sighting of Jean Lafitte fighting, Pierre Lafitte, his brother, did fight, but his men certainly did. And Jackson, after the war, they said, what do you want in return? He goes, could you expunge my record? He said, sure. Would you pay me? He said, yeah, I'll pay you. Sure enough, when Jackson went back and told Madison they expunged his record, they lived up to the deal he gave. I think if you follow the timeline of Jean Lafitte, I think he went back to being a pirate. I guess he was just too cool.
Okay, he couldn't quite change his ways, huh?
Yes.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Fox News's Brian Kilmeade in just a moment. Wi-Fi is something you really don't think about until you don't have it or it's not working properly. Video buffering, Wi-Fi dead zones when you roam around the house, too many devices connecting and slowing everything down. With the holidays, there's always more people home connecting their devices, all fighting for Wi-Fi. But when's the last time you upgraded your Wi-Fi at home? If you just want better Wi-Fi everywhere, check out an award-winning Orbi Wi-Fi system from Netgear. Orbi is the simplest and smartest way to get super strong, fast Wi-Fi in every corner of your home. One Wi-Fi network that's easy to install, you can set it up in minutes, and then you and the family will be enjoying faster, more reliable whole home Wi-Fi from your basement to your backyard. So what are you waiting for? Change your Wi-Fi world and get Orbi, that's O-R-B-I, Wi-Fi system from Netgear for better Wi-Fi everywhere. Visit netgear.com/Orbi. netgear.com/ORBI. And now, back to the podcast. Well, you were just talking about how hard it was for Jackson when he had to go on horseback to survey the land around New Orleans. Jackson's army was vastly outnumbered, so they couldn't afford to adequately defend the entire city of New Orleans. So Jackson calculated that his best chance was that he had to be very good at predicting which of about a dozen avenues of attack the British would pick. How did he go about assessing those?
Well, I mean, basically he looked and watched and hoped they landed here, and they landed at the perfect place. And it just ended up where... So you had a bunch of admirals, and just like in everything in our business, too, people looking to posture themselves, to put themselves forward. So the guy that was going to lead the troops is General Packenham, but he's not there yet. He got delayed. So Wellington, whose forces just defeated Napoleon, were sent right over to America. And Wellington said, I'm not going. And he said, why? He goes, I don't promise myself much success there. So he had trouble fighting us because he knew that America doesn't lose and say, here's my white flag. We melt into the woods and come back and fight you again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Washington lost all these battles, but he ultimately never quit and wore the British out. And Jackson would have done the same thing. You would have had to fight him right up to Mississippi. He wasn't going to stop. So he didn't want any part of that type of warfare. And he sent his guys and his brother-in-law, Packenham. But his brother-in-law arrived late. They said he was a very smart general. He never would have landed where these other guys landed. So when he lands, he goes, guys, pack up, bring the cannons out, put out the fire. We got to come at a different place. We are hemmed in. And they looked around and go, no, if you don't think you're the type of general that can lead us to victory, we're the British. You know what kind of success we've had already. So if you don't want to, we'll lead them alone. You can go back and explain that to the king, why you wouldn't lead the fighters. And sure enough, he's like, all right, fine, I'll work something out. Every time they probed our lines, they got repelled. So they realized they had to go over a moat and a wall to get to us, and we're better shooters than them. So they decide they're going to come up with an idea. They're going to make ladders. They're going to send yeah. one unit up, put the ladders over the canal, and they're going to, the next wave is going to run up the ladder and kill us all. Well, the problem is the people at the ladders are on a suicide mission, and if you're holding the ladders, you're going to die. And when the war starts and the battle begins, the ladders never come up. And the brigade was mostly Irish. And my sense is the Irish go, yeah, excuse me, I don't even like the British. I'm not going to go do that. So there was a court-martial for this, and the commander of the unit ended up getting off. But the ladders never show. Packingham can't turn around, so he sends his men forward. Not only do his men get annihilated, he gets killed. Two generals, seven colonels, over 70 officers wiped out. We lose only 19 or 13 guys, 39 casualties. They have over 300 killed, 450 missing, which means they were essentially blown apart. Mm. And you have over 2,000 casualties on their side, rapidly. And some of them played dead because they said, oh yeah. my goodness, I'm never getting out of here.
Yeah, wasn't it like 500 soldiers just played possum?
Yeah, they said it was. They thought it was the resurrection, Jackson said. As soon as they put up the flag of retreat, Jackson looked down. He says it was like the resurrection. All these men arose from the dead.
Yeah, I wonder. It's hard to tell if Jackson won the Battle of New Orleans or if the British lost it, because there's a series of mistakes that they make. Another one even before that, where when the British make landfall, they could have marched on the city and possibly taken it, but they chose to get a good night's sleep and fight fresh the following day. They didn't get a very good night's sleep, as it turns out.
Happened? Yeah, I mean, but one thing, thanks for reading the book.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. I mean, you really get into it. Essentially, what Jackson said, they will not have one restful night of sleep on our soil. So as soon as the sun set, these partiers who just got on land and were going to take their time taking New Orleans, and literally New Orleans looked exactly the same, they say. It was Bourbon Street. It was still Party Town USA and Party Town World. So they said, we're going to take our time and wait for the rest of our guys to come. And we not only attack them, we attack them with hatchets and bayonets and guns. So the militia that ran from pressure, that the British were so confident because they had 2 years of success against us, all of a sudden, we end up showing, Jackson under his men show how ruthless and determined we were. We cut them up. They have over 500 casualties in a matter of hours, and we leave on our own, not even forced out.
Wow. And after the Battle of New Orleans, I wonder how much of a factor was the fact that Napoleon had broken out of Elba and was possibly threatening Europe again? How much did that factor into the calculations of the British to decide to let this go and go back home?
You know, I didn't really quantify that. Mm-hmm. I would say this, the British were looking for total victory. And, you know, I think that the fact is they were tired of war. It was very costly. They think they sent the right message. And they thought, you know, we got basically sidelined America. They weren't anticipating this type of final battle annihilation. So I think that played a role. But you know what I think a bigger role was? Defeating Napoleon and sending those 40,000 troops over. Because the thought with Madison was, they're not going to want to fight us. It's too far away.
Yeah.
We're not, you know, they're not going to want to. We're just going to send a message to them, and we'll have a few skirmishes, and that'll be it. And next thing you know, we're up to our knees fighting for our utter survival, and then they go for the total kill.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ended up coming back, and then we would never be invaded again. You know, what was interesting is the 200-year mark in 2015, they did a big reenactment. I used some of the footage on the special, and the British helped. The British actually helped, provided some funds and some people
really?
To recreate the battle. Huh. I mean, that's how far we've come.
Yeah. A lot of historians like to say that the War of 1812 ended in a draw. Do you agree with that?
I do, in a way. But for us, it was a win because we stood up to the world superpower. It's almost like standing up to the bully. And we said we're going to be here for the – we show we're going to be here for the long term. In fact, I have a quote in the book. I haven't memorized it from Jefferson. It said, we sent word out that America, when challenged, will fight. And unfortunately, the rule of the grammar school playground still holds up today. You have to – we want to intellectualize out of it. We want to think that we're past it. But in the end, anytime you show compassion or a willing to acquiesce, it's interpreted like weakness. And the fact is we're willing to fight and did fight, and word went out when I told you of the Barbary Wars and Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates, we would do what Europe wouldn't. That's engage the enemy, the big bad enemy. We did it on land and sea. And here we are, we're willing to take on the world superpower, and we're able to survive. I didn't realize till I really started researching this how much the world wanted us to fail, because if you're a king or a queen, you don't love the idea of elections and leaving power. And if America worked, it was attracting the best and the brightest from around the world even then, and those people looking for a fresh start. And if people were actually playing a role in government and giving up power voluntarily, that wouldn't bode well for the dictators around the world. So one thing everyone agreed on, they wanted America to fail. And after 1812, it proved it wouldn't. Unless, of course, we wanted to tear ourselves apart. And that happened in the Civil War.
Yeah. Well, what would have been the consequences of losing the Battle of New Orleans, potentially?
Well, I think they set up an Indian nation right in the Midwest. Number two, I think the West Coast becomes a separate country. Wow. And maybe becomes an extension of Mexico. I would think that America never reaches its economic potential, and if it may, might never, for 50 or 100 years, ever get Florida.
Wow.
So I mean, literally, Jackson took the momentum from the War of 1812 and took Florida in 2018. And I spent last weekend in Jacksonville with a big statue of Andrew Jackson sitting right over there, named after him.
I want to ask you a little bit about Jackson himself. He's such a character. There are a million different crazy anecdotes about him. Describe his personality, what he was like as a guy.
Oh, man, he liked to protect those who couldn't protect themselves. So there was a great sense of protection of the country. He always walked around like he would never take a backward step. And I think one of the quotes was this from his mom: make friends by being honest, keep them by being steadfast, never tell a lie, nor take what is not your own, nor sue for slander, settle the cases yourself. That's why he would say, okay, you have a problem with me? Let's shoot it out. Let's have a duel. I mean, he wasn't the only one doing that, but there was a sense that he was willing to take on everybody. As a judge, he was a law and order judge. There's this one story about this drunken man, big behemoth of a guy, who cut off his son's ears. And then when they said that this guy needs to be tried for attempted murder and needs to be jailed, the marshals came up to him and said, I can't. The guy won't give himself up. I can't bring him to justice. So he goes, no, I tell you to go bring him. He goes, I can't. He says, I'll go with you. He hopped on a horse. He and the sheriffs go out. They go up to the guy straight ahead, and he says, you'll come with me. You're going to have your day in court, and you'll do it now. The guy looked back at him. He was twice the size of him and says, I'll only surrender to you. Wow. There was something about Jackson that got everybody's attention. And he also would not suffer. If you deserted, he'd shoot you. And when he went in for president, they would roll out pictures of the families of the people he shot, of the kids he shot, and said, this is the family where you shot their 18-year-old who volunteered simply because he didn't want to go into war anymore. So, in fact, that quote that I had wasn't a paraphrase. Here's the exact quote. I was born for a storm, hence his dad died and his mom died and his brothers died, and a calm does not suit me. That sounds very much like Trump.
Yeah.
So Trump never wants two calm days. And you think it's beyond his control. That's very much like Trump. I'm born in a storm. I'm happiest in crisis. The other thing is, in terms of battle, he was the calmest when things got the most stress-filled. Grant had the same quality. They say Washington had the same quality. When things went crazy, he went calm.
I think my favorite thing about Andrew Jackson is he's the only president who beat his own attempted assassin within an inch of his life.
Do you believe that? With a cane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, given that so many of America's important figures are being reevaluated these days, when you look at the sum total of Andrew Jackson's life, where do you think his line in the history books ought to be?
Well, here it is. I put him up there as one of the great presidents, most impactful presidents. You know, Democrats love him for a while, until recently. Republicans didn't. You know, they thought he had too much power, that he didn't respect the levers of power enough of the other branches. They didn't like the fact that he hired his family around him because he didn't know who else he could trust in Washington. I don't know who else does that. It's on the tip of my tongue. I can't really think of it. So I think that he is looked at as one of the critical presidents and a critical time in our country's history. Don't walk up there and say he's perfect. I mean, Washington wasn't perfect. Jackson wasn't perfect. But, man, you're going to be studying him. If we're taking an objective view of American history, he's always going to be among the top five presidents. Mm-hmm. Unless, of course, we really want to rewrite history. Here's his farewell. I thank God that my life has been spent in a land of liberty, and that he has given me a heart to love my country with the affection of a son, and a son to his country, a father to his people. He felt as though our welfare was his responsibility. And people sense that across the country. Nobody, the founding father, which is comical, I know, everyone was upset when Trump criticized Obama and Bush and Clinton. Can you imagine criticizing your predecessors when they're Jefferson, Adams, loved Washington, Jefferson, Adams, and Madison. And that's who he was critical of. He goes, you guys don't like me, I don't like you. That's fine. So, I mean, that was the attitude. That's why the people loved him.
Yeah, you were just alluding to the comparisons between Donald Trump and Andrew Jackson, of which there are many. President Trump, in fact, has hung a portrait of Andrew Jackson in the Oval Office. Before we go, do you feel that those comparisons are apt?
In some ways, sure. I mean, Jackson was born without parents, no money, and Trump had parents and money. But they become very wealthy. Jackson's self-made, and Trump just, you know, after ups and downs, ends up close to a billionaire. Now we have the similarities are they're both ran as outsiders. Both their candidacies were not considered be taken seriously originally. Both felt as though the press had it out for them. Believe it or not, Jackson hated the press even more than Trump hates the press. And there's proof of it. When I took a tour of the Hermitage, and it's in the special, I see these binders on the floor. And I said, what are those binders? He goes, well, he got 13 newspaper subscriptions a month. And every article about him that he thought was inaccurate, he would put in a binder and make notes. So when he met the reporter, he would actually make them correct it or defend it. And there would be notes in the columns that says, not true, never happened, find him, big X's in stories.
If only
so
he had Twitter.
I mentioned criticizing predecessors and hiring his family, never really being trusted, and thinking that they're the voice of the people. So that's how they rally. I mean, Jackson did something nobody else has done, and that is zeroed out the debt and balanced the budget. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that Trump can do that.
Yeah. Well, and I should mention that President Trump actually endorsed your book as well. That's pretty nice to have.
Yeah, that was stunning last week.
Yeah.
I mean, the book has already been out for a month, and I guess he saw me promoting the special, and I guess he tweeted that out, and I was on the road, and someone said, look what just happened.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting time. I'm honored he knows who I am.
Yeah, that's a pretty nice endorsement.
I know most of the people you interview are not fans. I've known him for a while, and I'm very intrigued how this thing's going to come out.
Well,
I know he's far from perfect, but I also think that a lot of people are going over the top to criticize him when you really don't have to.
Yeah.
I mean, you could call balls and strikes.
Do you like him? Do you consider him a friend?
I do. And when Jon Stewart came out a month ago, and after I don't know if it was a statue debate or whatever, and said, in defense of the president, he is a bad person. Huh. And I go, you know, it's a good line, but I think it's just actually the opposite. If you judge somebody on how they treat people they need nothing from, he grades extremely high. I mean, I watched him for 10, 12 years. I watched him interact with people, whether in a restaurant. We took him out every year for like a few years because he was on our show every week. On Christmas, I go, listen, you're the only contributor that doesn't go to our Christmas party. So we went out and we take him out to lunch.
Really?
And we talk. And from the waiters to the people who deliver the papers and we're filling up the USA Today canisters at the time, to the makeup artists, to the audio people that work he knows the name of the audio people who work for The Apprentice on the reality show, to the receptionist. The rich people don't like him. Everyday people like him because he treats them the same. And I just think he grades high on that. And he's a very unique character. I mean, I have known no one who could become a reality show star. We go from a millionaire to a billionaire. I don't know anybody that can go from a non-politician to president. So I don't know how to judge him. But I know that he does not have the arrogance. He's more approachable than unapproachable. And he's more confident than arrogant. And I find him very endlessly interesting. I'm shocked at the level of criticism for him. I always expect criticism of a president. I never expected anything like this.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your coming on the show, Brian. The book is called Andrew Jackson and the Miracle of New Orleans, The Battle That Shaped America's Destiny. Brian Kilmeade, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Ben Mathis, continued success. Congratulations. It's really nice of you, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks again to Brian Kilmeade for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Andrew Jackson and the Miracle of New Orleans, The Battle That Shaped America's Destiny, on Amazon, or download the audiobook on Audible. You can catch Brian Kilmeade on Fox and Friends and on his radio show, The Brian Kilmeade Show, every weekday. For more information, visit briankilmeade.com and follow him on Twitter @Kilmeade. Today's episode was sponsored by Credible.com. Credible.com is an online marketplace for student loan refinancing. Using Credible.com's simple platform, it takes less than 2 minutes to find out if you're overpaying on your student loans. You could save thousands by refinancing. All you have to do is visit Credible.com/kick, answer a few questions, and right away you'll get real rates, not ranges of rates, from multiple lenders. Checking your rates will not affect your credit score, so you really have nothing to lose. The average user who refinances through Credible.com saves almost $19,000 over the life of their loan. And for a limited time, my listeners will get a $200 welcome bonus when refinancing through Credible.com/kick. That's Credible.com/kick. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter @KickassNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.